So you're giving a kind of full-on review of Ajahn Chah according to the Western disciples. And you can see how much he did affect our lives in just one Northeast Thai monk had such a kind of impact on us. So I remember he was, I was the first Westerner, so he did give me an enormous amount of attention for the first 2 or 3 years, and I really appreciated that because it felt wonderful being kind of special and admired, and it took me to on a trip to the Northeast, to meet all the great Ajahn Mun disciples. So it took me and another monk, Ajahn Mahamon, who'd been coming from the Bariati background. He was quite well known in Ubon as a teacher of Pali and scripture, and then suddenly he gave it all up to live at Wat Pa Pong, which was quite a, you know, if you know that this, he had such a prestigious position that he was destined to be gain kind of status, increasing status, but he gave this all up to be a disciple of Lungpa Cha. And so he, but he was very well educated and had a lot of kind of intelligence around the, you know, he could deal with the Bangkok people, with the upper classes, and with the administrative Thai Sangha. And so we were kind of special monks that Lungpa took to on a, he said it was going to be a tudong, but I found out we were going to sit in a car. We went up to visit the various famous Ajahns of that time, and almost all of them have passed away, except Ajahn Mahabua. We went to see him, and then and they would be talking, and my Thai wasn't all that good at the time, and I like to record everything, so. So why? I can't tell this. No, I'll never get through it. But anyway, I was the first Westerner to learn the Padimokkha. And so this was, and I remember when I first attended the Padimokkha, when I first went to Wat Pa Pong, I thought, wow, I'll never be able to do that. You know, sit down and recite Pali, all the disciplinary rules in about 40 minutes. You know, I thought, my God, these people have such incredible memories and I'll never be able to do it. So I kind of made up my mind I wasn't even going to try. And then, around my fifth year as a monk, I learned this Padimokkha. And I became quite, and Lungpa would praise it no end. And so when I first recited it at, Wat Pa Pong, you know, he gave me so much praise. He went into the sala and told, Padimokkha was done in a separate place, and all the lay people were there for the observance night. And he was kind of raising me up and praising me. And I was very speedy. I could recite it faster than almost anyone else. And so, and this I took great pride in also. And And so this was quite a big thing in my life, being the, you know, considered one of the top Padimokkha chanters. And like Kitty Sorrow being a champion wrestler. And then I remember when Paul Breiter came, Marpagno, and I remember when he first came, I thought, this is really a basket case. And I remember carrying water with him, we had to carry on a pole, and we'd draw water from the well, and then put these big kind of kerosene tins and on this bamboo pole. And he went first, I remember, and I was behind him, and as we were carrying, he walked right into a tree. So... So then, I can't, poor chap, you know, he's got problems. But then I began to notice that Lung Po Cha seemed to really take to him and took a lot of interest in him. And then one day, Paul Breiter, or Warapanyo, chanted the Patimokkha. It was brilliant, Patimokkha. And I have a problem with jealousy, see, so. And then Ajahn Chah said, Morapanyo, he chants a Padimokkha, and better than you, Sumedho. So he'd build you up and then knock you down. But then I appreciated this because, it's what I needed. I needed that kind of reflection for my emotional life. And Lumpa was that honest and compassionate to be able to do that, even though, and he did it with such, I mean, it was humorous, like he had a twinkle in his eye. He knew he was being nasty and saying something that, a bit, you know, pointed and rubbing it in. But yet, in some ways that made it even more acceptable because I could see he was right. You know, that was true. And that he wanted me to see there's this kind of jealousy and this pride in having regarding myself as such a very good as having been one of the best Patimokkha chanters. Now you can see even in the monastic life you can use it for position and how competitive it can get. You know, just to see. I remember at Watnanachat we used to almost compete with each other, who could sit in full lotus the longest without moving, and things like this were quite common to us because our nature is very much like that. It's a very competitive country, this one, and men tend to be competitive because of that. We see each other in relationship to who's better and who isn't. He was also at the time when I first went there, the town monks were very, critical of him. And so my upachaya, the preceptor, had come to visit me at Wat Pa Pong, and he took me to the main monastery in Ubon City, and the head monk there of our sect was a really grumpy type man. I mean, his face was just the perfect kind of example of grumpiness, and he sat there, and he was obviously he was very irate about me being at Wat Pa Phong, so he started talking to my preceptor and telling me that it wasn't proper, the legal rights to the land wasn't proper, and that food wasn't any good, and that I should come and spend the Vasa with him in Ubon. And so my Upachaya listened, and I didn't really understand it all, but when we left, the Upachaya said, what should I do? And he said, well, you spend the Vasa or the rains with Ajahn Chah and just see, if you can't stand it, then you can come back to Nong Khai. So this, during the Vasa, the beginning of the Vasa, Lungpa would take us to visit the kind of high-ranking monks in Warin, which is a provincial town, but it's right across the river from Ubon, so they're kind of like one city, really. And so he took me, and when we went to see this monk in Ubon, he looked really angry, and he would hardly speak to Ajahn Chah. Ajahn Chah made all the right gestures. We'd make these trays up of candle incense and flowers, and we'd ask for forgiveness for any of our wrongs, and we go through this whole kind of traditional ceremony that we have as monks. And Lungpa was always incredibly charming and polite, and you couldn't fault him, in terms of the monks in the town who were so jealous. They as much as they wanted to get something on him, nothing would really stick. And I just noticed that he would go and he'd make all the right gestures, and then the head monk there looked really angry, and he didn't like me being there at all, because it drew attention to Nong Pa Phong at that time. So then over the years, we kept going back, and Ajahn Chah was also very kind of non-sectarian in his attitude. So there are two sects of Theravada Buddhism in Thailand, and we were in the large one called Mahanikaya, and then the Thammayut sect was the smaller one, but it was very prestigious. It had all the forest monks in it, most of the, like Ajahn Mahabua, and Ajahn Mun was the Thammayut monk. And the royal family tended to favor the Thammayut sect. So they had a kind of high status in the minds of people. And Ajahn Chah had great respect for the Ajahn Mun, he considered his teacher. So we would always go to both the head monks of both sects in Ubon and Warin. So at this Vasa time, so we'd go and do this ceremony. And so he became quite respected in the long run by both sects. And then when I went to live in England, it was in 1977, Ajahn Chah told me before he left, he went with me to England, before he went back to Thailand, he said, you must stay here 5 years before you ever come back to Thailand. And so I promised I would do that. So then he left, and during the first year, I wanted to go back to Thailand, I don't know how many times. But his order that I not go back for 5 years, I decided I must honor that. So I stayed on, and then finally after 4 years, I went back at his invitation. I went back to Thailand, and the ironic thing was that before I left for the England in 1977, there was a branch monastery, and they were very eager that I come to their Katina ceremony, which is the ceremony after the Vasa. And I was so fed up with attending all these Katina ceremonies. As the branches increased, then there were more and more of these ceremonies, and they were so utterly boring, and endurance contests. then I was expected to go to these because I was the abbot of Wat Nanachat. So anyway, this one I quite rudely refused to go to. I'm not usually very rude, but anyway, I was quite rude to this monk and the lay committee and refused. And then the irony of that was when I went back in 4 years later in 81, the first thing that happens to me is I go to see Ajahn Chah, and I don't know if he even knew about this rudeness of mine 4 years before, but suddenly he asked me to go to this katina, the first thing. So it was like almost the first, within a few days of arriving, I had to go to this katina. And I did, though. I didn't refuse a second time. But then, also, he asked me to go to, several years later, asked me to go to a very important funeral in the town. And I went, and there was this monk that had been the head monk that used to despise Lumpur Cha. And he was there, but he'd now been raised up to a higher position. And he comes over to me with a smile on his face, and he says, talks to me in the most ebullient terms, and pray paeans of praise towards Lumpur Cha, and how much he admires and respects him. So, and I've noticed that even now in Thai society, Ajahn Chah has really established, he was such an impeccable monk, that there was no way either sect could really hold anything against him. So now he's kind of mutually admired, and both the sect, the Tamayut Mahanikai, regard him very highly, and he was never one to spread gossip or talk badly about other monks or about the other sects or about his own. So I mean, it was this kind of samawaja he had, this kind of ability to, he could be quite outrageous and even vulgar, and but his speech really was never got into ridicule or spreading gossip or rumors about others. So this also one knew was a part of the trusting relationship he built, how he could make fun of us. But it was all right because there was no malice behind it. You know, it wasn't, one felt it was never malicious or mean. He was never trying to harm or hurt us. It was always this awakening sense of making us look at what we're doing, look at ourselves, look at the here and now. Something, a kind of example for all of us who live in, you know, we have our own groups, our own monasteries, and our own different ways of doing things. But Lumpur Cha always allowed margins for differences and for practice. It was not a kind of rigid adherent to an absolute form or formality. So I'll share this with you this afternoon.